Right, so I am the other Lauren, but I'm also going to be looking at treatment, but we're going to be taking kind of a diverging path in terms of looking at a little bit more biological remediation using flowing stream wetlands. So for those of you who don't know what flowing stream wetlands are, that's okay. Hang with me, you will be enlightened. But we're going to look at them for two cases, that of nutrient and pathogen remediation. So while I don't usually do this, we're going to take you through a quick overview of what I'm going to be looking at because it might be a little overly ambitious and a lot of information at once. So I'm going to talk to you about what flowing stream wetlands are. Then we're going to look at three different studies. One is going to be specific to looking at actual nutrient remediation. The second study is going to look at the effects of different water chemistry parameters on the efficacy of flowing stream wetlands. And then finally, we're going to touch on pathogens and their role with flowing stream wetlands. And then I'm going to let you take it all home and tell everybody about how great flowing stream wetlands are. So start with, y'all all know about the nursery and greenhouse industry, but the variability of the nursery and greenhouse industry is significant. And that's part of the reason why having a basis in this information is really great, because knowing these different water quality issues and the wide ranges of variability we see in nursery and greenhouse runoff is really important. And so in particular, in this water quality issues of effluent, we see things like plant pathogens, high nutrient levels, which lead to ultimately algal blooms and retention ponds. We can see issues like suspended sediment, metals, herbicides, pesticides. And while there's potential that flowing stream wetlands can remediate all these, for this talk, I'm just going to be focusing on those top two. So in particular, in nursery and greenhouses, we see effluent levels for nitrogen and phosphorus that are very high. So we can see, for example, in nursery industry, all the way up to 135 milligrams per liter of nitrate nitrogen in runoff, or 20 milligrams per liter of phosphate. And this is even higher within the greenhouse industry, all the way up to 381 milligrams per liter of nitrate nitrogen from the greenhouse effluent. And so having these elevated levels of nutrients is a concern, especially, in ecological senses, but then furthermore in terms of being able to reuse this water on site. And a large part of that is due to that algal bloom, which I'll talk about in a second. But flowing stream wetlands have been a technology that, or a science that's been around for a very long time, because these are actually naturally occurring. And so you can have floating reed beds out in our wetland systems that occur just naturally, like I mentioned. And so taking that natural technology and then adapting it in engineering systems is what we consider floating treatment wetlands. So a floating treatment wetland is different from a wetland because that system is elevated and floats on top of the water surface. And that, therefore, exposes the roots directly to the water system rather than having them submerged within soil or some other media. And so, therefore, it promotes a kind of a greater microbe habitat and direct treatment of the water source itself. Furthermore, there's other benefits like an edge shelter, wildlife habitat. The fact that it can float and change with water levels is significant, as well as the fact that it's very easy to install and relatively low cost in comparison to other installation technologies like flow sand filters, etc. So now that you have kind of a basis in what exactly floating stream wetlands are, what is their role in nursery production? So when we look at nursery and greenhouse operations, typically they have very clean water that then leaves the operation with potentially enriched nitrogen and phosphorus levels. In many cases across the U.S. for nursery and greenhouse production, there are already capture systems in place that capture that runoff. And then either hold them and release them off-site or hold them and then potentially recycle that water. And this is where the opportunity for flowing stream wetlands comes into place, where we can then suspend these systems on the surface of the water and then treat that water prior to release off-site or reuse. So to move first into that nutrient uptake, this was important not only to have an idea of the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that can be removed by these plants, but furthermore, as I mentioned, there's great variability in runoff. And so great variability means great variability in terms of the nitrogen and phosphorus that are coming into the operation, as we kind of saw earlier. And so what is that change in the level of nitrogen and phosphorus that's coming in through their runoff? What does that affect on the plant's efficacy as well? So in order to do this, we conducted an experiment in 2015 in which we looked at two specific plant species, Juncus effusus and Ponderia cordata, which are two typical wetland plants. We looked at them furthermore at two different nutrient levels, so at a high effluent of 12 parts per million nitrogen and then a low effluent of 3 parts per million nitrogen. We then loaded these plants for 20 weeks, taking water samples and then finally plant samples in order to essentially determine the nutrient uptake and the nutrient remediation of that effluent by the plant. So here you can see that we definitely had different efficacies of our plants and survival depending on our nutrient loads. So you can see, especially in the Ponderia, that the low effluent loads of nitrogen cause some chlorosis and yellowing of the plant, whereas the high concentrations, the Ponderia, were absolutely in heaven. However, while you can't see it as well, there wasn't quite as much difference, at least in physical appearance, in the Juncus. So the Juncus were able to handle the differences in effluent levels, whereas Ponderia had definite physical differences or physical appearance differences. Furthermore, whenever we looked at this in terms of the actual remediation, here we're looking at the concentration in the water and looking at that change in concentration over time. So this blue line is the effluent that is entering into the system, whereas the orange bar indicates what was leaving the system at the end of each week. And this is over the course of that 20-week experimental period. So you can see that the Ponderia had significant treatment and reduction in concentration of nitrogen over the course of the experiment, both in high and low. But Juncus, on the other hand, did not seem to reduce that level of nitrogen nearly to the same degree, which was kind of interesting. And furthermore, like I said, that high versus low was a significant player in this, although we didn't see many differences once again in that Juncus, whereas they were very obvious within Ponderia. Phosphorus, if I were to, you know, not have distinguished between the two, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It behaved much the same as the nitrogen did in terms of its remediation over time as well, where high concentrations in Ponderia, we saw large amounts of removal, whereas it was not significant for Juncus in terms of its removal of phosphorus. So cumulative removal over time, though, was significant in the sense that nitrogen removal at 12 parts per million, we removed 148 pounds per acre over that 20-week period using Juncus, and 862 pounds if we were to extrapolate it per acre for Ponderia. Whenever you're looking at lower effluent levels, obviously you're removing a less amount of phosphorus and nitrogen. And so phosphorus removal, when we're talking about a phosphorus level of 3 parts per million, we were removing 16 pounds per acre and 106 pounds per acre, respectively, for Juncus and Ponderia when looking at phosphorus. But since phosphorus is a huge issue, even removals at this level could be significant in terms of reducing downstream issues or recycling problems for growers. One of the things that is also interesting is the wide range that we see in terms of treatment at both different application rates for nutrient loads, but then furthermore, the plants. And so this is some work that was previously conducted by Dr. White. But you can see that depending on the plant that was trialed, the removal is different. And so what this tells us overall is that plant selection is important, and I'm going to talk about that plant selection component a little bit more here in a second. But furthermore, a lot of growers ask us, well, why are you trying to remove the nitrogen and the phosphorus from my water? Like, that's what I'm trying to apply it to my plants anyways to begin with, and so why are you looking at doing this? Why wouldn't we just reuse the nutrients that are already in our water? And that's in large part because whenever that water is sitting in retention ponds or sitting in those containment holding bins, we often see large flushes of algae and duckweed. And that can be a negative because these cause clogging within irrigation systems, a strain on pumping systems, and can ultimately lead to an increase in costs or labor issues for the grower. And so that's one of the great things is that by reducing these nutrients, we actually see a decrease in the amount of algae and duckweed that occurs within the system, ultimately benefiting the grower just due to their irrigation system costs. So, like I said, we wanted to kind of look at this furthermore in terms of water quality for different water chemistry parameters, so specifically looking at alkalinity and pH. So when we're looking at alkalinity and pH, for example, just in the U.S., we have a wide range in pH of what we're putting on our plants. So growers are applying anywhere from about 3.3 to 10.4 pH in their irrigation systems to their plants. So if we assume that the water that is leaving these facilities is fairly similar to what they're applying, that means runoff can therefore be variable all the way from 3.3 to 10.4 in pH as well. Same thing with alkalinity. You're looking at all the way from, you know, an alkalinity of 2 milligrams per liter of calcium carbonate to 575, which is significant. And so knowing that this wide variability is once again an issue within our nursery and greenhouse industry, it's important to therefore know if those differences in water chemistry can affect the efficacy of floating treatment wetlands. So in order to assess this, we set up a trial system using 45 different trial containers and then looked at 5 different pHs in the beginning of 2015 and again in 2016. And these pHs were 4.5, 5.5, 6.5, 7, and 8.5. The plants were then treated with 10 parts per million nitrogen fertilizer solution, and we looked at 3 different plants, 2 grass species and then an iris. And we took water samples and plant samples in order to see what the changes in nutrient levels were and if there were any differences between these different pHs. We then repeated the experiment later in both 2016 and 2017 using 5 different levels of alkalinity, 0, 100, 200, 300, and 400 milligrams per liter of calcium carbonate. And this was once again to see the effects on the ability of that plant to remediate and remove those nitrogen or those nutrients from the system. So, whenever we were looking at alkalinity, we saw overall that over the course of a 7-day period, the end remediation levels for nitrate nitrogen were relatively the same and insignificant in terms of differences for all 5 alkalinity levels. So both, for example, iris and sada and panicum hematomen, while they had maybe some level of remediation of nitrogen, it wasn't a lot, and it wasn't necessarily significantly different between the 5 levels of alkalinity. Why this is important is because when we look at, for example, acidity and looking at pH, we can actually see that, for example, iris and sada had a significant remediation of nitrate nitrogen from the system, and that furthermore, all 5 pHs had this same level of remediation. So pH essentially was not important in terms of iris's ability to remove nitrogen from the system. But as y'all have already jumped ahead and seen, it is significant whenever we're looking at panicum hematomen. We do see significant differences in terms of the ability of the plant to remediate nitrogen from the water system when treated with different pHs. And why is this important whenever we're discussing all this? And ultimately, it comes down to plant selection, because it's not going to just be a one-shoe-fits-everyone sort of solution. If we're going to use floating treatment wetlands within our nursery and greenhouse industry, we really need to understand what is coming off in their effluent in order to adapt our floating treatment wetlands to their practice. Furthermore, plant selection could be important in terms of plant pathogens. And so in order to determine if different floating treatment wetlands and would be susceptible to plant pathogens, essentially serve as hosts, we were looking at some different literature. And so this was conducted by my colleague, Natasha Bell. So please don't ask me any really in-depth questions. But basically, the idea of floating treatment wetlands and the remediation of Phytophthora is just not well known. It wasn't studied. And so we were trying to determine, do aquatic plants that are typically used in floating treatment wetland systems, are they susceptible to Phytophthora, therefore serving as a host and basically allowing Phytophthora to continue to produce spores that would then potentially be could inoculate and infect the plants that as the growers were using this water. So they could therefore then be serving as contributing propagules to the receiving water system. So in 2016, 2017, and 2018, some plant susceptibility trials were conducted using 7 different wetland plant species and then 5 different common nursery and greenhouse species of Phytophthora. And so we essentially exposed these 7 species to these 5 different Phytophthora pathogens. And so first we disinfected the surface of the root systems for these different plants in order to make sure that they weren't already infected with these pathogens. We then established those plants in a fertilizer solution and suspended them on the surface of the water similar to floating treatment wetlands. We then inoculated those plants with zoospores that then released through plug systems the zoospore, or essentially the Phytophthora species, into the water. After 6 weeks and after continuously baiting for and to determine if there was actually a presence of those pathogen zoospores within the water solution, the plugs were removed and the plant was then placed into a new clean pot in order to determine for another 6 weeks following that if actual infection occurred. So following that period, then the plants were rooted or were plated out with their roots in order to determine if growth was going to, or if Phytophthora infection occurred on the roots themselves. So in 2016, there was 0 infection of the root system by any of the Phytophthora species on any of the plants, which was great. But whenever we redid the study in 2017, we actually found that 3 species of plants were infected by 5 different species of Phytophthora. Phytophthora cryptogea, Cinnamomum, Nicotiana, 3 different species. But we still had no infection by Citropthora or Palmivora. So seeing that we had great differences between 2016 and 2017's results, in 2018 we moved forward trialing only those plants that were found to be infected during the 2017 trials and using the 3 different Phytophthora species that we had found infection by. And in the 2018 trials, we found infection by Typha latifolia by Phytophthora cinnamomum. So what's interesting about this was not only this difference in the affected plants versus the non-affected plants, but furthermore was the presence of zoospores activities with and without plants. So when plants were present, or I guess whenever they were not present, so essentially the control, we found a fairly high incidence of zoospore presence throughout the experiment, which would be expected that the plug is releasing zoospore and it was present. But without plants, you can see that the detection of those zoospores was significantly reduced. And so this is meaning that the plants are in some way playing a role in terms of the reduction of the Phytophthora species just by their mere presence. And so this is really interesting. And so going forward, we're looking at these pilot scale vegetated channel experiments in which we can see especially with our non-susceptible plants that we trialed, are they actually going to naturally filter and reduce the Phytophthora species and just all on their own? Do they create a reduction? And if so, how does that work? So just some take-home concepts for floating treatment wetlands. Essentially, that competition, that reduction of nutrients reduces the aquatic weed presence, which can help with long-term irrigation management. Nutrient uptake occurs differently at alkalinity and pH, and it's very plant specific, and so further research needs to be done in order to better understand which plants will perform well at different alkalinities and different pHs. Plant selection, as I mentioned, depends on your water quality, and so this is very important in order to understand, like I said, one shoe doesn't fit all. We need to better understand which plants we're suggesting for different systems. And finally, there's a really good chance that floating treatment wetlands can play a role in plant pathogen control and in helping to basically mitigate pathogens in the downstream irrigation systems of these operations. So I have to thank a lot of people, including Natasha Bell and Dr. Sarah White, as well as our funding from NEPA and through the Clean Water 3 project. And if there's any questions, kind of, maybe like one. Yeah.
Did you all recover, did you test Phytophthora within the water or just the roots?
Both. So there were both the baits in the water and then the baiting of the plant, of the roots after harvest. And so that's what was significant about this, is that this was actually baiting with just in the water column, and that we saw suppression of the pathogen in the water column itself, not necessarily even within the root structure, which was, you know, as I had kind of mentioned previously here, there was some infection, but it was this fact that within the water column there was suppression as well.